Believe in yourself, cause it starts with you, and then everyone else will believe you too. And if it looks like you're the only believer around, just keep on believing, don't put yourself down, just believe.
Our guest this week grew up in Minneapolis, Minnesota, and earned a bachelor's degree from the University of Denver. A hippie, he began selling stereos in 1973 for Sound of Music, a small chain of stereo stores. The Sound of Music was the precursor to Best Buy, which was formed in 1984. He rose through the ranks of the consumer electronics retailer Best Buy, and from 2002 through 2009 was its CEO. His name? Brad Anderson. And I'm Jack Krasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. I'm Jack Krasula. This is Anything Is Possible, and we're talking to Brad Anderson, the former CEO of Best Buy. Brad, welcome. A real honor to have you.
Oh, thanks. It's a big honor to be on the show, Jack.
Can we start by talking about your childhood?
Yeah.
And your mom and your dad?
Yeah.
Please.
Well, I was really fortunate. I grew up, didn't realize it at the time, but I grew up a child of a pastor. Most of our lives spent in Minneapolis. So I had the life of a pastor's kid. Pastor's kids in general have a terrible reputation that we earn. Most of the time, if someone who's not a pastor kid can relate, because you get a chance to sit and listen to your father speak uninterrupted for 20 minutes every week. And so by the time you decide to get into a little bit of rebellion, it gets challenging. And my dad describes me as the worst confirmation class kid he ever had. So I grew up in a very happy family. But I was the unsuccessful child of my brother and sister and I. I was not a good student. Went to high school. When I graduated from high school, I went to a school in which 90% of the kids, public school in Minneapolis, but 90% of the kids went to college. And when I graduated, my guidance counselor said, you know, Brad, some people are cut out for college. You're clearly not one of them. And the evidence he had for that was that I got pretty mediocre to terrible grades when I was a student. And I really thought I was pretty stupid. So I was lucky enough to get into college and actually started to enjoy learning in college and did a little bit better. But by the time I graduated from college, I actually tried to follow my father's because what my father's desire for me, and I went to the seminary for a year and dropped out of the seminary after a year and took a job as a clerk in a stereo store, as you mentioned earlier, Sound of Music. At that point, I thought I was kind of lost. I loved music, so it was fun to be doing that. But I had gotten to a point where, after getting a college education, everything else, I was working in a store and didn't look like I had much of a horizon with it.
So it's 1973.
Yeah.
You're a commissioned salesperson at this Sound of Music, and in the first 2 weeks, you knocked the socks off. You made $69.
Yep.
And you say, I want to quit.
And I was maybe the worst salesman they'd ever hired. Because if you can imagine, if you can work for 2 weeks and make $69, I didn't sell much of anything. I was a terrible salesperson. And it was a sort of a further... And I went in and quit. And I literally went in and quit after the first 2 weeks because I was making about 60 cents an hour. And they said, well, we need you to stay at least long enough for us to hire somebody to replace you. So... at that point, I was so frustrated with my inability to sell anything that I got desperate because I didn't know how to sell. I was failing. And I thought, well, what if I did something for a customer that nobody else in their right mind would do? And I had a customer come in, and he lived about 60 miles away from the store. And I sold him a set of speakers, drove it to his house, installed them on the ceiling. Spent an enormous amount of money and resources basically doing it. But it was my first big sale. And kind of, it was at that point it clicked that really what business was about was delivering more to something than someone, than somebody, more value than someone else would. And I went from being unable to sell to being pretty good fast. And it was sort of that realization that turned things around for me, and I started enjoying what I was doing.
Brad, what do all great salespeople have in common?
I think every great salesperson I have met could be for a whole bunch of different reasons, but believed that someone that they're selling to should be buying from them. Could be for good reasons or bad reasons, but they have a confidence and enthusiasm and a belief that is magnetic and causes people to buy. If you've been in the sales area, it's amazing to see one person can oftentimes sell more than 10 or 15 other people can at the same job. And it is that it's something about that enthusiasm, confidence that inspires people to want to buy from them.
I've been amazed through the years. So many of the greatest salespeople I've met have been great listeners. Why is that?
The best salespeople are great listeners, and that's if you think about it, I told you that illustration of selling. Well, the only way I found out that I could give an advantage to this gentleman by delivering and installing his speakers was I found out what he needed by listening to him describe why he was in the store. And it sounds so simple, but it is so seldom used that if you take the time to really listen to the customers, they're going to give you the clues of why they're there in the first place. And if you respond to that, you have a huge advantage over somebody that's not listening.
We're talking to Brad Anderson. And when he was the CEO of Best Buy, he had 170,000 employees, 4,000 stores, and sales of $50 billion a year. And I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. Welcome back to Anything Is Possible. I'm Jack Rasula, and we're with Brad Anderson, former CEO, Best Buy. Brad, arguably the greatest motivational speaker of the last 40-plus years was Zig Ziglar, who passed a couple years ago. His first book was See You at the Top. It was published in July of 74. 41 times in the book, he states, quote, "You can get everything in life you want if you will just help enough other people get what they want." Is that still true today?
Yeah, I mean, it's some of these leadership principles sound so simple that they're sort of easy to overlook. But if you help, I mean, I really think that's the core in kind of any leadership job, is if you can. If you listen, not dissimilar to what we were talking earlier about selling, if you listen to what an employee is looking for in their lives and you honor what they're what their needs and what they're looking for, and you provide them with a path and you have some faith that they can do more than maybe even they think they can do, absolutely amazing things get done by human beings. And so that sort of realization that you're dependent upon the desires and talents and of the person that you're working with on any path you choose is true. And the more you really honor that, the more you're able to get done with other people. I think probably we'll all have to learn it in our own individual experience, but it's astonishing. I talked earlier about how much one salesperson could do compared to others with the right enthusiasm frame of mind. Same thing is true in terms of leaders. But the leadership has to honor the person that they're leading and really respect and listen to and believe in the talents of the person they're leading in order to be able to do that. So I think Zig was on to something substantial. That's probably why he's lasted.
Speaking of leadership, tell us about Dick Schultz.
Well, I my first opportunity to really work with Dick, as I mentioned earlier, I was a successful salesman, and I was running this tiny store in West St. Paul through most of the 70s. And by the end of the 70s, give you an idea how hard business can be. But Dick Schultz is the founder of Best Buy. He founded the company in 1966. By the end of the 1970s, the company was basically financially insolvent. We were losing $200,000 a year on $4 million in sales. And I thought Dick came out to fire me at the store because a lot of other people were getting fired at the point in time. And he actually came out to talk to me about that he needed new leadership, and he was looking at three different people who had worked for me. And completely out of character, I said, you know, I think I'm the person that should be leading. That really was the turning point for me, where I got an opportunity to, instead of just being a store manager, to step in with Dick and try and fix the problems that Sound of Music was facing. But the really amazing leadership lesson I learned from him, and it was right at that point, is every piece of evidence you had. You literally, when you got paid on Friday, you ran to the bank because it was the first guys that got to the bank that were able to cash their checks. We had a negative net worth. Things were going terribly from a performance standpoint. And as I'm spending my time getting to know Dick, Dick's believing that we're building a successful company, and instead of a $4 million company, he thinks he's building a $50 million company. And he is unwavering in his enthusiasm, even though there's no real evidence that we've been very successful. And I first thought he was crazy, and I've subsequently come to realize that that's the genius of every entrepreneur, that their focus is on the future, and their confidence is able to sustain through all the buffering that you get in terms of experience. And Dick's actually extraordinary in the sense of, in terms of, once he sort of envisions something, he believes it's a sure thing, it's going to happen. And that provided, you know, that provided room for the rest of us to challenge our own capabilities and see what we could do.
Speaking of crazy, you came up with the idea to transform Best Buy from a product distribution company to more of a service company. Many said you were crazy. Why'd you do it? How did you do it?
Well, it was going through the same themes again. The Best Buy's success over the years, and we took that tiny little company and took it, as you mentioned, from a $4 million company into a huge company. It was all based on listening to our customers and realizing that the customer had different needs constantly. I mean, the consumer electronics business is such a magnificent but always in transformation industry. And Best Buy's initial success had been as a big store retailer, was breaking away from the rest of the competitors by making the store simpler to shop, getting rid of commissioned salespeople, putting the customer more in control of the transaction than had been the tradition of the business. But by the time I became CEO in 2002, the industry was changing, and these are ways that still aren't really resolved in the industry. But the complexity of making all the products that you buy work together was really getting in the way of the customer fully utilizing the experience of the product. And that's still, if anything, it's even more so true today. And so I tried to re-engineer the company, so we moved to try to see if we could solve some of that complexity, and that really was more of a service proposition than just a distribution of product challenge.
In 2002, you acquired the Geek Squad, which had 45 employees.
Yes.
No doubt the majority of your current employees said, "What are you doing? Why are we hiring these geeks?"
Well, we started doing something we called customer centricity, which was we identified customer segments that we wanted to serve, and every one of the segments that we wanted to serve needed a much better service experience, and Best Buy did not have a tradition of being a good service company. And we had this tiny little company based in Minneapolis, which is where our headquarters were, or are, and they did an extraordinary job with their customers, even though they were just a few people. And they had the same kinds of thing I talked about earlier. They had a founder who had this sense of mission in terms of what they were going to do. And so we bought the Geek Squad to sort of bring a better set of practices and better capability in and see if we could deliver that for our customers, because the customers that we were talking to really demanded that experience. And initially, the really critical component was not have the habits of Best Buy dominate, but had maybe take on these new habits that the Geek Squad had, and that's what we worked to try to do.
You mentioned a minute ago customer centricity. You led an initiative that you termed the customer centricity strategy. Can you delve into that a little more?
Yeah, well, that was, you know, that was, this goes all the way back to when I was a salesperson or a store manager, ultimately, in that little three-person store. I watched what happened from the corporation standpoint, and I was there for 7 years in this little store serving the same customers in a neighborhood. And it never seemed to make sense to me. I couldn't figure out why we were getting the orders we got from the corporate office that seemed to be the antithesis of what our customers were asking for us to do. And when I got into the office to try to help fix that with Dick Schultz, the insights I had were the insights I had over that 7 years of, you know, being in a position in which I was at the ground level working with the with our customers, trying to serve them. And I found those things worked. but I also started to see very quickly why corporations and why, the minute you get very far away from a customer, you start to really lose the impetus and the insight that is coming from a customer. And I also knew something else about, as an employee, when you were asked to do things that dissipated your mission because they weren't consistent with what you saw the needs of the customer were, you started to deteriorate the performance, your own performance, and the performance of the company. So customer centricity was about trying to get the insights, instead of coming from a corporate headquarters, that every employee in the company potentially could be in a position in which their insights could be used to drive the strategy of the company. So like earlier I said, we bought the Geek Squad. Well, we bought the Geek Squad out of insights that came from employees they're dealing directly with customers and what they couldn't solve that the customers needed solved. And so we basically set out to see if we could grow the company by taking those insights from and the creativity of the line level employees to be able to find new value proposition we could grow the companies. And that worked extraordinarily well. And the other key thing it did was every employee knew that potentially they, no matter what your status in the company, you could potentially help reinvent the company. And that, I think that helped both with the quality experience that the customers delivered, that the employees delivered to our customers, but it also allowed us to find new talent in the organization, and it sort of de-risked the strategy because we were listening to things that were happening right in the experience between the customer and the employee.
We're talking to Brad Anderson, and I'm Jack Krasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. This is Anything Is Possible. I'm your host, Jack Krasula, and we're with Brad Anderson, who started out selling stereos and rose to be the CEO of Best Buy. Brad, people say you've done a lot of crazy things, and you make the decision, we got to let, you know, the individual sales reps tell us what to do. That's great in theory, but you had 170,000 employees, and the average age was 22. So you decided you're going to let these 22-year-old kids tell us what we should do. That's nuts. That's nuts.
No, it actually sounds nuts, but it isn't. Because my choice would the other choice would be to maybe hire somebody from with a Harvard MBA and listen to them. But the problem for listening to them would be they were sitting in an office somewhere in Minneapolis looking at abstract data. And in my experience, they were much less likely to give good insight than the 22-year-old talking to a customer.
You your whole life was dependent on the millennial generation.
Mm-hmm.
Talk to us about the millennial generation.
Well, especially as a parent, I think that one of the things that I've seen, and I'm now 65, so in my life, is that we as people search for the thing we don't have. And, when I was a kid, you were lucky if you thought you could kind of select your career. And as the society's gotten richer, people have, and as the tool sets that we use, a lot of which are provided by companies like Best Buy in terms of it, allow us to engage with the world and sort of collapse the differences in information, et cetera. The expectations of people to be able to participate have exploded. And the ability, we all walk around, anybody with a smartphone is walking around with this giant library in their hands, and they can access almost any information their curiosity can come up with. And that's also potentially empowering. And the millennial generation is growing up with those almost like being an extra digit on their hands, so that they're used to the tool sets, they're used to being able to access those things, and they're used to an ability to participate. That I think makes them different and potentially enormously capable and productive in a way that should substantially supersede, say, my generation, which is the baby boomers. So I'm very excited to see what the millennials do. And I also think that people, may not look this way, but I think people, as the society's gotten richer, our spiritual needs become more important to us than other things are. And I think that's also going to be part of the journey that the millennials have.
Yogi Berra has a saying, the future ain't what it used to be. Brad, 50% of the 7 billion people on Earth are 25 or under. When I listen to people that employ these millennials, they use two words for them, me and now. How did you use that as a plus?
Well, that went back to the customers, the customer centricity. Trying to get that channeled to the point where they could actually, they were expected to participate was really important. If I knew I should respect them, and again going back to that, if there's a theme through all of this, it is that listening and respecting your customer and listening and respecting the person that you're leading. It provides enormous options and enormous for anybody who's lucky enough to get a chance to lead in their lives. And in some way, I think we all lead in different kinds of capacity. So that sense of being there listening and then having high expectations for what people are able to do, if you really give them an option to do it, and if they're doing something in a space they're actually really inspired to do, I just have found over and over again people accomplish extraordinary things. And so now you also have a generation with great tool sets that expects, maybe a bit spoiled, but they expect to be able to participate. And that combination can be extraordinary. And and we see it in different places. We see both. We see what happens when that generation's not inspired, which is not good. And we see some amazing things coming out of inspired people from that generation. And as I was trying to lead in a way that would look like the better side of that too, of those two options.
All right, you adhered and you live based upon four core values. That's good. But then when people read these four core values, some would say, this guy is totally nuts. Number one, honesty and integrity. You cannot be successful today being honest and having integrity.
I thoroughly disagree. I think it's impossible. Even some of the biggest scoundrels I know had to have some part of the, or had to have some place where they could be trusted, or they weren't really functional. I'm a huge reader of history and biographies, and certainly when it comes to business, if there was a single trait that I used to go speak to my dad had me once go speak to a bunch of pastors because I wanted to share what I found in the business world that really surprised me. And the first thing I found was that the most important value that an employer has is to be able to trust somebody. That unless you're an idiot, and if you're handing, like when Dick Schultz handed me the responsibility of helping to change Best Sound of Music then, if he couldn't trust me, he was crazy to hand me responsibility, because I would only take away things that he owned. And he had to be able to have reason to believe that I had a core that was trustworthy for me to be able to use any of the talents that I had. And so that, well, the reason that's first is unless you actually behave in a way that indicates that you have a set of values that make you trustworthy, most of the rest of the things, you're not going to be able to build anything to last.
Value number two, embracing challenges and change. Most people say, I don't want any change. I resist change. You want to embrace it. Why?
Because this goes, first of all, in the industry that we're in, nothing stays the same at all. So that unless you, that was to alert anybody that was working inside of a company like Best Buy, and I think this applies to anything in the consumer electronics industry. That industry is a revolutionary industry. It's constantly, our expectations for what the new iPhone is going to do or the next product are extraordinary. And unless the industry meets it, it has profound ramifications. We never had from one Christmas to another. We never had the top selling product was the top selling 2 years in a row. Matter of fact, usually whatever was the hot product 1 year was a drag on sales the next year. So we had to reinvent ourselves constantly. So that was to tell people to do it, but it was also to help people prepare for it. That also means that you're invited to help us change, because we need your insight to change. And so that's why it's in the value system. You expect to be in a place where you're going to be challenged, and we're going to need your ability to adapt. And if you want to sit here and stay the same, it's not going to be a good place to work.
Number three, unleashing the power of people. We've talked a lot about that. Number four, having fun while being the best. Please.
Well, maybe this is a little like Zig Ziglar. If we're right about the first three value systems, we're gonna do a lot of good things, and we're going to have a lot of success. And I believe that the most important moral thing for any of us individually to do is to be happy. And the process of joy and celebrating how lucky we are to be alive, and celebrating things that are successful so that we inspire more of it, is fuel that replenishes that source. So we wanted to state that as a core value.
We're talking to Brad Anderson, and one of the things he celebrates publicly is his failures. When we come back, we'll ask him about celebrating failures. And I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. I'm Jack Rasula. This is Anything Is Possible, and we're talking to Brad Anderson, former CEO of Best Buy. Brad, you celebrate your failures. You talk about them. Why?
Well, everything that, you know, at my stage in life where I'm retired and 65 and getting a chance to look back on a lot of experiences and a lot of joy that I had in the work I did, the very best moments all grew out of doing something that either failed enormously or where we got ourselves into so much trouble that we almost caused the company to fail. And that the learning that goes on when you've made mistakes and the flexibility and creativity that occurs when you're trying to fix them, and the fact that the mistake is forces you to have to deal with your own failing. It stimulates great learning, and out of that learning, we always found opportunity. And so we used to do things like failure forums. So when we do something that wouldn't work, we would, you know, bring it into an auditorium and invite everybody to come and listen to it, and have the people that made them, you know, led the process or participated in the process talk about what went wrong. And it was always the fuel to the things we did that didn't go wrong. And oftentimes, I mean, I know that in the Silicon Valley, from what I understand, people that invest in new companies are looking usually for people who've already had one or two companies fail before they put their money in, because they want that experience of failing. And if you look at some of the great success stories in business these days, they're come out of, like the Best Buy story comes out of, they come out of a lot of failure before you have these success stories. And we share the success story, and oftentimes not the failure, but the failure is essential to get to the success.
Are you telling me, Brad Anderson, that when I miss a 2-foot putt, I should celebrate that?
I
do a lot of celebrating then, that's for sure.
I've never had the impetus to want to do that either. That's why I don't golf. But yeah, actually, you should, because it either is telling you one of two things. Maybe you should quit golf, or it's telling you there's an opportunity to do this a lot better than you just did.
A few years ago, I was blessed to have Gene Cernan on, the first American ever walk in space and the 12th and the last man on the moon.
Yep.
And he talked about how they went to the moon with less technology than we have in our cell phones today. Talk about the power that we have, that we hold on to in these cell phones.
I serve on a bunch of boards. I'm actually back on the Best Buy board these days. The technology that is sitting in a cell phone, and the things it enables you to do. I mentioned earlier that it's like you've got a vast library in your hand. You've got the stuff that a cell phone is, you've got a camera. You've got a terrific camera. You have an actually film camera and a still camera. You go on and on and on in terms of the capacity that's sitting in that. It's a bank. And what's coming in terms of the next generation, one of the things we're dealing with, say, at Best Buy as a technology company, it's racing to try to be able to make the rest of the company work with the capacity that's already sitting in, say, an iPhone 6, so that you can buy something by just simply using your phone and passing it over. The kinds of things, the technology that's already there, that will transform how convenient and fast we can get things done in the world. And if you look at it, 20 years in human history is like a blink of the eye. And most of this technology that we're seeing applied and the way the Internet is integrated in our lives has all happened in the last 20, 25 years. It's an absolutely extraordinary thing that's happened. I think we are the luckiest people to be alive now in all human history, because we are getting to experience so much capability being delivered to the average human being. It's completely historically unprecedented.
Brad Anderson, talk to us about leading a public company in a Christ-centered manner.
Well, I came to, I mentioned going to the seminary, but I don't think I was, the strength of my faith came out of the experience that we've been talking about. I sat and listened to my dad's sermons, and particularly the parables, and when I got a chance to lead, I really didn't have, I didn't have an MBA. I didn't have anything to prepare me to lead, except for the stories that had really been given as a child. And I would take those parables and actually, because I was doing a secular leadership, couldn't use them directly, but I try to learn and understand from them and see how they applied. And I found that there was extraordinary insight and value, and it made leadership clearer to me, and it really deeply enhanced my faith. If you look at, say, the parables, they are so full of what appears on the surface to be complexity and contradiction, but you put them into the world, I think they really help you understand human nature, understand my own individual search, and also understand the components of leadership.
You and I met through a mutual friend, Steve Silver, a great,
yes,
great guy. And 12 years ago, he started Men's Golf Fellowship, where 12 or 13 times in the winter down in Naples, he has terrific, very successful people come in to talk to a couple hundred men about their faith journey. You've attended a lot of those sessions. What have you learned from those speakers, Brad Anderson?
Well, I think you see, for people that have been lucky enough to be successful in terms of leadership, a lot of times that success is instinctual. And what's interesting with what Steve's done is it's sort of helping people, I think, understand a leadership journey that at least the operating side for many of the folks down here in Naples is because they're retired, is in their past. But help them see and begin to understand how their own stories fit into this biblical story. And that, and maybe things that they weren't so aware of when, lots of times people who are in business careers become so totally absorbed in sort of the practical things that they're doing that they miss the larger things. And I think Steve has hit a vein in terms of starting to bring the sort of larger themes to of some very successful people in a way that they can hear. And as we hear stories from people, they kind of reaffirm this. They reaffirm again and again the significance of and the wisdom that is sitting in these stories, and how they directly, you know, I talked about the parables earlier, how almost every one of these stories is somebody's individual parable, and that they share with these groups, and what we can learn at this stage in our lives from this.
Brad Anderson, as our time winds down together this evening, what advice would you give to our young listeners?
The biggest thing is to not listen to anybody that's telling you how little you can do. First of all, I really believe everybody on this planet has got some mission. There's something that they're uniquely gifted at that the world needs. Finding it for people like me was very hard to do, but there is a clue that we all get, which is that if we're doing something that really is something we're kind of designed to do, we can tell because you lose a sense of time. You get so engrossed in what you're doing that your sort of body comes back and tells you this is something you love to do, and if you can find a way to use that in your career. And I think virtually everybody can if they work hard enough at it. I think people can accomplish extraordinary things, and the oftentimes we don't because we fall into this path of listening to the obstacles instead of looking for the potential. And I really think it's important for young folks, if there's a single thing, is just don't lose that optimism. It's false if you lose the optimism, because also, as we talked about earlier, when things are frustrating and don't work, and those are usually the source for other great things. So don't lose those lessons, and don't lose the enthusiasm about your contribution. I just haven't met anybody that doesn't have something that they can deliver to the rest of us.
Brad Anderson, you are the epitome of a true servant leader. Keep up the great work.
God bless. Thank you so much.
Please join us next Sunday. Until then, I'm Jack Rasula. Thanks for listening. And make it a great week, because with God, anything is possible. Spahom.
Believe in yourself.